right. Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
I'm Sammy Smart.
I'm Aiden Tong.
And I'm Zoe Power.
It's Thursday, June 14th at 5.02 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. This week, we're joined live in the studio by Sydney Ball of the Vancouver Tenants Union Steering Committee to take a deep dive into British Columbia's housing crisis. Sydney recently presented the union's 50-point plan for housing to the newly established Provincial Housing Task Force and will be sharing with us what the union sees as essential to addressing Vancouver's housing crisis, as well as how their suggestions were received and what we can expect from the task force in the future.
Next, we'll bring you the latest developments in the race for City Hall, with updates from Jean Swanson's campaign launch and Cope's nomination meeting held over the weekend. We'll also be bringing you a special report on the death of Anthony Bourdain through the eyes of Vancouver's culinary community and the impact he had on the lives of so many, as well as some resources to refer to you in case you are struggling.
To end the show, we'll be joined by a defendant in the case against Kinder Morgan to find out what it's like to appear in court against a powerful corporation and learn about how Kinder Morgan's injunction affects protest and civil disobedience on Burnaby Mountain. But first, we're bringing you headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with our special headline correspondent, Andy.
Official complaint lodged over Vancouver's police carding of Indigenous and Black people. A formal complaint has been lodged with the Office of the Police Complaint Commission by the BC Civil Liberties Association and the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, who allege that VPD street checks disproportionately target Indigenous and Black people. Street checks, or carding, is the process of police stopping and gathering information from people on the street even when they are not suspected of a specific criminal offense. Data published on the VPD's website shows that between 2008 and 2017, 15% of street checks conducted involved Indigenous peoples, despite them making up only 2% of the city's population. 4% of checks involved Black people, who make up less than 1% of the population of Vancouver. VPD Chief Adam Palmer has rejected allegations that street checks are ethnically motivated. He'll be further addressing the issue at a press conference today. And we'll keep you posted on that story. People are going to die protesting Trans Mountain Pipeline, former Bank of Canada governor says. David Dodge said at an event held in Edmonton on Monday that he believed the government must ensure they enforce rules allowing the construction of the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion, despite the risk that some people may die fighting against it. Dodge blames the activism of Not In My Backyard or NIMBY opponents for likely project delays, even when these projects have met world-class environmental standards. While he won't speculate on how fatalities might occur, he does say that he's worried about extremist minorities amongst the pipeline opponents. Are we collectively a society willing to allow the fanatics to obstruct the general will of the population? That then turns out to be a real test of whether we actually do believe in the rule of law. Finally, BC Agency releases first guidelines on treating youth with opioid use disorder. The British Columbia Centre on Substance Use has released new guidelines for treating young people suffering from opioid use disorder, with the emphasis on providing a range of pharmaceutical and counseling options and cautioning against the traditional approach of using detox alone. The first of its kind, the document will provide both physicians, patients, and family members to better engage and navigate addiction treatment therapies. It will also provide greater resources for self-advocacy for youth who are struggling with opioid use disorder. 1/5 of all illicit opioid deaths in BC are people between the ages of 10 and 24, making the previous lack of youth-centric treatment plans particularly problematic. The current guidelines do not allow for youth under the age of 18 to receive drug replacement therapy using medications like methadone, and youth under 18 who do suffer from severe to moderate addictions, preventing them from accessing medically proven treatment just makes no sense. In addition to providing greater treatment options for youth, the guidelines offer a more holistic approach, providing counseling and mental health disorder screenings. Should the transition to adult-oriented services be required, there are recommendations that the shift from youth to adult services be done gradually so as to limit disruption.
Handsworth evacuated following bomb threat. According to North Vancouver RCMP, a bomb threat was made to Handsworth Secondary today, Thursday the 14th. Everyone was evacuated and, soon after, all students were released from class for the rest of the day. The police with an explosive detection dog declared that the threat was false. We wish it remains that way and we hope no one was subsequently hurt from the panic. And those were the headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
Okay, and in response to another headline from this week, Democracy Watch reporters Sammy Smart and Aidan Tong were able to do a short tribute to the life of celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain, host of the show Parts Unknown and No Reservations. Sammy was fortunate enough to also get an interview with one of his friends, a chef here in Vancouver, who's also a renowned chef. The content of this report does mention suicide and mental health issues, which may be triggering to some listeners.
Anthony Bourdain lived life to the fullest, with an open mouth and an open mind. Expanding his culinary curiosity, he saw food as a gateway to connect people and a natural medium to expose the similarities between individuals. In 2008, Anthony Bourdain featured Vancouver in an episode of No Reservations, in which he explored the city and met with three highly respected chefs. Chef Vikram Vij, Chef Pino Pistoraro, and Chef Hadikazu Tojo. Democracy Watch reporters Aidan Tong and Sammy Smart were fortunate enough to get an interview with Chef Vikram Vij and find out why Anthony Bourdain will be dearly missed.
Well, Anthony was just not only a good friend, but also somebody whom I deeply respected and loved at a friendship level. And I think what I'm going to miss the most about him is his joie de vivre way of being and how he didn't have any hierarchy between his friends and how he just felt really comfortable.
Absolutely.
I remember a scene. We had gone to the Indian stores at Punjabi Market on Main and 49, which is predominantly Indian area. And we were filming there, and he got no attention because obviously no Indian knew who this guy was. Tall, lanky, white dude, with a cigarette in his hand. And I was walking with him, and I was getting all the attention, and people were coming up to me and wanted to take photographs and all that stuff. And he looked at me after a while and says, "Dude, this is crazy. Nobody recognizes me here." I said, "Yeah, this is my turf. This is my area." Took that into a stride and didn't flinch or didn't get his ego hurt. And to me, that single-handedly was his biggest attribute, that he never got his feelings hurt. But he has hurt us by leaving us in a way he did.
And when you heard that he passed, what were your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts was this a terrorist attack? Then my initial thoughts changed from where he was, because as I read more that he was in France, my parents was somewhat a crazy gunman took his life. Maybe something did happen. Mm-hmm. Then later, I thought maybe it was an accident that he was on a shoot and something happened to him. Like, you know, he drowned because he did daring things like this. I think the last thing that came to my mind, and it's still, I'm still struggling with it, that he took his own life. I'm still really struggling with it. I do not know. I do not know what to make out of it. I'm still confused that that could be possible, because it was just no idea.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a shock. And so he was in Vancouver for his show No Reservations back in 2008, and that brought together local chefs Hidekazu Tojo, Pino Pistoraro, and you. And what lasting impact did that visit have on you?
Well, the show itself was very well done. He did a great job of that. It solidified our friendship. Mm-hmm. I had only heard of him at the time when I first met him. it solidified our friendship to the point where when he was working on this project in New York where he was going to bring cuisines from different parts of the world together, he had asked me if I was interested, and he wanted to wanted Vidges to be represented in New York. That didn't pan out just because of the timing of it and where we were and everything. But the lasting impression was that I just respected him for what he thought and he believed in, and how successful he was in his way of talking and treating and being with everybody else, and he was really genuine.
When asked about Anthony Bourdain's career as a cook and a storyteller, Chef Vige spoke on what he thought was Bourdain's legacy to this world.
He was actually a master storyteller. He was somebody who would brought people together on the plate. He believed that the plates tell stories of the food, of the culture, of the history where people come from. So for him, it was not about it was not about being the best chef or putting the best plate together. It was more about how do I bring people and their stories. So he was a master storyteller. That's why I think I'm going to miss him the most.
The world lost a true artist, an explorer, and some would say America's best diplomat. Anthony Bourdain will be missed by so many, but what is most significant about this news piece is the importance of reaching out to others if you are someone who struggles with mental health. There are always people to reach out to, be it family or friends, and even resources like Crisis Center BC. They provide mental health support lines as well as a dedicated seniors distress line. You can contact the mental health support line at 310-6789 and the Seniors Distress Line at 604-872-1234. There's also a 1-800-SUICIDE line, which reads out to 1-800-784-2433 for anyone that is having thoughts of suicide. These hotlines operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and are available in over 140 languages. If you'd like to speak with one of their trained volunteers, please call. Again, the mental health support line is 310-6789. The seniors distress line is 604-872-1234. And the suicide line is 1-800-784-2433.
Many Canadians struggle with mental health. A locally available resource for crisis is Crisis Center BC. If you or a loved one is struggling, call 1-800-SUICIDE or 1-800-784-2433 for help 24/7. Help is also available online at www.crisiscenterchat.ca for adults and www.youthinbc.com for youth from noon until 1 a.m. It's free and anonymous. For out-of-province crisis lines, please go to www.suicideprevention.ca/need help to find your local crisis line.
All right, thank you to Aidan Tong and Sammy Smart for their beautiful piece on the life of Anthony Bourdain. We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back soon with a special guest for more Democracy Watch.
Hub Cycling is hosting Bike to Shop Days on June 22nd to June 24th. Come out and get advice on the gear and techniques that allow you to easily use your bike for shopping trips. There will be route maps for shopping, celebration stations, which have info, snacks, and free bike tune-ups, discounts at local shops around Metro Vancouver, a passport challenge where participants collect stamps at celebration stations to win prizes, guided rides, and riding to local stores to show support. Check out bikehub.ca for more information.
Better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change.
Hi, and welcome back to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, and we're lucky enough to be joined now live in studio by our very own Sydney Ball. Sydney Ball is a member of the Vancouver Tenants Union Steering Committee, which recently published a document containing 50 recommendations for the improvement of BC's Residential Tenancy Act, and much more, as we're about to find out. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Just to start, before we get into any more details, who are the BC Rental Task Force that you put these recommendations towards?
Yeah, so the Rental Housing Task Force was an initiative of the provincial government. So it's led by Spencer Chandra Herbert, who is the West End MLA. It's kind of like any other government consultation where they'll just be talking to groups that they're calling stakeholders. So that would be tenancy groups, landlord groups, real estate groups. And then they're doing a couple public consultations with they'll have recommendations for legislation probably in the winter. Yeah.
Cool. Obviously, your document has a lot of recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to summarize that to a few general points that you'd like to see addressed, what would those be?
Well, our number one priority before anything else is something we're calling real rent control, which is called vacancy control. Vacancy control is a system that limits the amount of annual rent increases to once every 12 months. So that means no rent increases between different tenants or different landlords. And the reason why this is our number one priority is because, first off, it'll be like a really great action for affordability and stabilizing rents in total, but it'll also end all profit motivated evictions. So we also we know in Vancouver it's a really big issue that we see rent evictions all the time and fraudulent uses of the Tenancy Act, like landlord use of property. So a lot of people are being forced out of their homes with fraudulent evictions because the landlord knows that the next person they can get into the suite will pay more money. So if you can't increase the rent between different tenants, then we would completely see these kinds of evictions eradicated. The other thing is that there's been studies that have shown that all government money that goes towards poverty action, so like welfare, disability, as well as other subsidies like SAFER and RAC, get completely eaten up by rents. So without the stabilization, any kind of action that the government wants to take on poverty, like their $400 renters rebate that they proposed, earlier, is useless without vacancy control. We also think that it will kind of simplify the whole system. Arbitration is really complicated, and neither tenants nor landlords really want to go through a system that isn't considering bad faith for bad faith for evictions, meaning profit-motivated evictions. So we think that this will be a solution that really points to a lot of our other recommendations and kind of makes them, like, needless. So rather than addressing a lot of the different points in our recommendations, you could just do this one major change and it would have the biggest impact.
So just to clarify on that point, when you say rent wouldn't be allowed to be increased from tenant to tenant, but would be allowed to increase every 12 months. Mm-hmm. And I also noticed that your document recommended that the increases be capped at 3%, like in Ontario. So is the proposal then that rents could be increased once a year, but between tenants would be the only thing removed?
The 3%, like Ontario, is actually a reference to a current part of the Act where landlords can apply for rent increases based on unforeseen circumstances and expenses. So that isn't the annual rent increase. There's already a part of the Act that allows landlords, if there's some kind of like really unforeseen cost that comes up, they can apply for a rent increase. In Ontario, they can do that currently, and it's limited at 3% per year. Obviously, we think that like maintenance and that kind of thing shouldn't fall into that because proper business planning means that landlords should plan for maintenance. But in circumstances that are out like extraordinary, they already have a system to do this.
As we noticed throughout you document, you obviously mention the existing power imbalances and the relationship between landlords and tenants. Could you go over some of what you believe are the most significant of these, and how are they enabled by the current rules?
Right. So basically, I mean, if you're a tenant and you're facing an eviction, you're facing losing your home. In our view, that's very substantial and causes a lot of stress for tenants. So our second recommendation is actually something that is also similar to Ontario, where we want to reverse the burden on applying for residential tenancy grants arbitration. So currently, as it stands, if you get an eviction notice, you have like a very, very small amount of time, depending on the kind of eviction notice, to be able to dispute that. And when you're faced with losing your home, that's an incredible stressful thing. And landlords don't even need to have any proof. They don't need to have the proper permits in place to give out these eviction notices. They can be completely fraudulent, and the burden is still on the tenant to dispute these evictions. So one of our big recommendations is to reverse this process, so there's an automatic dispute hearing for every single eviction. And that is the current system in Ontario, so we don't see why it couldn't be here in BC.
Back to the vacancy control. Like, so what would that mean necessarily for landlords, I guess, besides the caps on rent increases?
That would mean they had a cap on rent increases. So that means that they wouldn't have any incentive to be getting tenants outside of their suites. There's already a 4% increase every single year. So if you think about that, it's 2% plus inflation. And if you aren't able to recover your costs with 2% plus inflation, you're probably not a good business owner. And we're treating landlords as if they're not like other business owners and they don't have to be responsible for those practices, right? So it's kind of, I think, a really common misconception that landlords wouldn't be able to pay their costs with this. They've already got like really wide margin of profit.
Yeah, and building upon that, I noticed that you also mentioned that the current Residential Tenancy Act, or RTA for short, protects landlords from ever running a loss. Is that kind of what you're referring to in that sense?
Yeah, they're actually protected from ever running a loss, which is kind of absurd, I think. But in that context, I mean, it's supposed to be because in the market that we have right now, we have a government that says that housing is a human right, but who's supplying that human right is actually a private market. So if you're looking at how is a private market going to give people something that's that should be available for everyone, because we understand it's a necessity for living, then there should be controls on that market. So that's kind of like, I guess, the tension there, is when we don't have any government spending on housing, when there's no really big action on social housing or building affordable units within government spending, then obviously we're going to have to rely on this private market. And currently the private market is taken up by speculation and investment. So it's not supplying people with the homes that they need. It's supplying people with an investment and way to make easy money.
So would you see most of the long-term reliable solutions to these problems coming more from government housing or like similar public initiatives?
I think that public initiatives on more housing and more housing that's decommodified and taken out of the market is a really great long-term solution and something we really need to consider if we do think that housing is a human right. But I think a lot of groups kind of focus on supply only, and supply is really important, but it's not useful without further protections for renters as well. We talk in our plan a little bit about a bill that's in New York called the Predatory Equity Bill, which kind of locates buildings that are bought by landlords with kind of recent rent prices or recent land prices, so astronomically large mortgages that they won't be able to pay off with the current tenants that are in there. You know, if someone's going to buy a building for that large of a mortgage and they can't pay it with the rents people are paying, that they're going to try to get those people out. So what we propose is the government does a system of low interest loans and helps tenants actually turn their buildings into co-ops. There just needs to be more action, basically, and more options for people to be able to find long-term solutions to housing.
Yeah, definitely some interesting proposals. Which kind of reminds me, after reading briefly about how, like, in Singapore, I think it was about 82% of the citizens of Singapore live in government-developed and owned housing. So definitely sounds like it's possible to some scale.
Yeah, I mean, it's like different in every context. The Vienna model is mentioned a bunch, but every single country has a completely different context for applying this. But what we do think is that radical spending in social housing is a way to actually shift perception and be able to acknowledge the fact that housing is a human right. So it's a really good ideological change for us as a society in BC to make.
And on that note, sorry. What would you say to those who might tell you that Vancouver is expensive, if you can't afford it, you should move elsewhere, which is something I've definitely seen mentioned a lot online.
Yeah, I know. We get those tweets all the time, which is ridiculous. It's like, who has the right to those communities? Who built those communities? And we were saying basically is that low-income people, so that's more often like people of color, people on welfare and disability, people with disabilities, people who are Indigenous. You're just saying that they don't have a right to the city. They don't have a right to live in the communities that keep them safe. They don't have a right to the services that they need to thrive. And I don't know how to respond to those people except for I hope that that sounds ridiculous. Yeah.
And finally to end, in your, say, utopian rental housing situation, what would be the setup, I suppose?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, my utopia is a long way off, but we do stand for the decommodification of housing. So I think as long as you're looking at a private market supplying housing primarily and you're looking at an investment market, it's nowhere close to the utopia that I would like to see. So we'll start with that. And by start with that, I mean we'll fight for that for the next many decades probably and then see where we're at.
Right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. It was very informative.
Yeah, we're super grateful for you to for coming in and chatting with us.
Oh my goodness, coming down the hallway. I work here, so.
Sydney walked approximately 15 meters, actually, because it's quite a long way around to be here, and we are eternally grateful for that effort. If people want to find out, if they want to read for themselves your recommendations, or if they want to find out more about the task force or the tenants union, where would you send them?
So we have a website, vancouvertenantsunion.ca. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, YVR Tenants Union. We have a general meeting coming up on the 23rd. So that's where all of our members get together and vote on really important directions for the tenants union. So we definitely suggest that you take a look and join and come and help us out so you get a voice in how we're going to shape the city.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much, Sydney Ball. I hope you have a safe trip back to the Discorder office, mm-hmm. at 15 meters. We are going to take a short break now, and we will return with more Democracy Watch soon, where we're going to hear more about housing with a report on Jean Swanson's campaign launch from this weekend.
Pinoy Pride Vancouver Society presents Liberacion, the first LGBTQ Philippine-X Pride Art Celebration, on Saturday, June 16th at XY Lounge, featuring performances by Kimmortal, Naomi King, Romeo Reyes, Well, Jade Soul, and Mevian Hauser, and works by Politique, Mildred Grace German, Clar Pond, Jose Luis Reyes, Cesarina Bravo Tabopo, and These Bodies Between Us. Check out Pinoy Pride on Facebook for more information. Evening in Damascus returns for its fourth year. Join us on July 31st as this fundraiser brings the soul of Syria to the heart of Vancouver with music, storytelling, dancing, wine, and food. All proceeds go to support queer Syrian refugees. For more information and tickets, visit eveningindamascus.com.
We're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, the News Collective's weekly local current affairs show. We just listened to headlines and will now turn to an update on the election race beginning to take shape here in Vancouver. Over the weeks, Jean Swanson held her campaign launch in Shaughnessy Park. Surrounded by mansions in one of Vancouver's richest neighborhoods, Jean Swanson advocated for rent freezes, taxing owners of mansions, and the building of affordable housing to end homelessness in Vancouver.
Here we are in a big park surrounded by $40 million mansions at Jean Swanson's campaign launch. There's gates everywhere. Every house seems very high security.
I just had, I guess, a young child ask its mom, why are the houses so big? Do giants live here?
I just wanted to say two main things today. The first is I've decided to try for the Cope nomination for City Council. And the second is that one of the main reasons I want to get on council is to try and end homelessness. Really, really end it this time. And here's how.
So last year Jean went ahead to reiterate the key points of her City We Need platform, which she launched a couple of months ago before announcing her candidacy for council this election. And what this is essentially based around is the idea that she put forward last year in the by-election of introducing a mansion tax on homes worth more than $5 million and using the proceeds of this tax to go directly towards housing Vancouver's homeless population through introducing temporary modular housing. And it's this policy, Jean would explain, that was the reason behind her unconventional campaign launch at the Crescent.
So why are we having this launch at the Crescent in Shaughnessy? So everyone can see with their own eyes how much wealth there is. There's 15 mansions on this in this circle here. They're all worth over $10 million. With a mansion tax on just these 15 mansions surrounding this nice little park, we could get 54 homeless people off the street in safe, secure, temporary modular housing in 1 year. So we're proposing, like we did last year, that we tax the value of mansions worth over $5 million by an extra 1% and over $10 million by an extra 2% and use that money to house virtually every homeless person. Yes. So we know that some mansion owners don't like this idea. That's why we brought this giant box of Kleenex for them. They have a few more options than a homeless person on the street or a working family with no inheritance. And in the end, policies like these increase the happiness of everyone. Studies show that in countries with more equality, virtually everyone, including the rich, live longer. And we all know, of course, that homelessness costs a lot. It costs more to keep people on the street than it does to put them in good housing, about $20,000 per person per year. And another good part of the mansion tax is that after we get homeless people off the street, we could start building beautiful, secure, non-market housing for renters who have to leave the city now because they can't afford the rent. The city says that there's about 20,000 renters who are renter households who are paying more than half their income in rent. So the market's not going to solve these problems, folks. Governments can hand out incentive after incentive to developers, and they will never build enough housing for people who are earning about under $50,000 because there's no profit in it. So we have to take the profit out of housing, just like we took the profit out of healthcare. Yes!
This point is undoubtedly what lies at the heart of Jean Swanson's campaign for council this year. And it's also what sets her fundamentally apart from other candidates who are putting housing forward as their single issue in the campaign as well. So Derek O'Keefe also spoke at Jean's campaign launch. He is now officially a Cope nominee for council as well. He's a longtime activist and founding member of the Vancouver Tenants Union. And here's what he had to say about the difference between Jean's Let's Fix Housing platform and that of Hector Bremner, who's also promising to fix housing and is rumoured to be starting his own party with that issue as the focus.
There are people who said last year during the by-election, and even before Jean ran in the by-election, Jean Swanson, she's too radical. I mean, great person doing work on important issues, too radical to run for an election. In fact, Jean's kind of radicalism is exactly the practical politics we need today.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because radical, the word radical just means to go to the roots. Hector's talking about fixing housing. Hector is not going to go to the root of the problem, which is the accumulation of capital and the housing of money taking priority over the accumulation of justice and the housing of people. So let's go to the root of the problem. Let's get a radical, pragmatic slate of councillors in power, and let's make Vancouver a city where thousands of people are no longer having to move out of town, where thousands of people are no longer having to move out onto the streets, and where thousands of people are moving into affordable, beautiful, comfortable, just housing solutions in every part of the city.
So Derek, who we heard from there, was just one of a suite of other COPE nomination hopefuls who turned up on Saturday for Jean Swanson's campaign launch as well. The official COPE nomination meeting was on the following day, so it wasn't until then that both Derek and Jean were officially sworn in as COPE candidates for council in this year's election. But Saturday was the first official announcement of Jean's intention to run as a COPE candidate this year, having run independently in last year's by-election, and this was some of the biggest news of the day.
So last year in the by-election, I ran as an independent, but I was endorsed by COPE. Thank you, COPE. We worked with COPE in the by-election, and they were great, and they have really good policies. And a few weeks ago, we launched the City We Need platform that calls for fighting for the things we need in the city, and COPE has included most of these in their platform. And COPE has a history of fighting for working people and tenants, and I ran with COPE 30 years ago. And it really seems to me that Vancouver needs COPE to make a comeback. Yeah. With the establishment parties falling apart, this is the perfect time for our alternative. So there's another reason that I'm really excited about working with COPE, and that's because they've attracted some really good candidates.
So this synergy between Jean's own ideas about the city we need and the official COPE platform was really evident on the day. Jean was actually flanked by COPE's two other official nominees for city council this year. So Anne Roberts, who will be running for council, she's a former COPE school board trustee and city councillor, spoke and introduced Jean at the launch. And as you heard earlier, Derek also spoke after her. Diana Day, who was endorsed on Sunday as a COPE nominee for school board, was present and introduced the event, as was Barb Parrott, who is COPE's other school board nominee. And of COPE's two parks board nominees, one was absent, but one, John Irwin, was present at the launch as well. COPE is yet to nominate or endorse a candidate for mayor, but will be expected to do so in August in the lead up to the election.
So with these candidates and all you fantastic volunteers, we can go out into the streets, knock on the doors, share our platform, and if we work hard, we can actually get the city we need. Yay! And that city includes winning a rent freeze where landlords can't raise rents 4% every year and where they can't raise rents as much as they like between tenancies. It includes a city where we use city powers to stop rent evictions in their tracks right now. It includes restoring indigenous land and working with indigenous nations for housing land trusts and to get that Aboriginal Healing and Wellness Center in the downtown east side. It means finally getting a ward system so you don't need big money to get elected. It means ending the criminalization of poverty and homelessness and transferring some of that money saved into services that people really need. It means stopping Trudeau's pipeline in its tracks and really doing our part to stop global warming. It means restoring Chinatown to the working people and the elders who live there. It means saving small businesses with their progressive business tax and working for a business rent control. And means implementing a real sanctuary city where people without documents aren't reported to border security by any city employees. So that's what we're going for, guys. Thanks so much, and girls, for coming out. I hope everyone can come to the COPE meeting. And then we'll keep working to use City Council to help us build a movement to get the city we need.
Mansion tax now! Mansion tax now! Mansion tax now! Mansion tax now!
So those sounds from Gene Swanson's launch event on Saturday were recorded by myself, Zoe Power, and News Collective comrade Sammy Smart, who is here to tell us a little bit more about how weird it was to have a Gene Swanson rally surrounded by mansions.
Yeah, it was definitely like a strategic location to make a point to like the richest neighborhood in Vancouver about like taxes and wealth inequality, because here's a bunch of people with a bunch of signs saying stuff like, we have to tax mansions and we have to freeze rent. We have to make it so they can't increase it by, 4% a year and between tenancies. Everyone was like really passionate about what was going on, and everything was very, very like hard left leaning, which I think is to be expected from like a progressive person running and launching her campaign. And a lot of people were talking at the mic and having some very, very passionate speeches about wealth equality.
Yeah, I think in the audio that we included there, you can hear Gene Swanson make reference to, this is why we bought them a giant box of tissues. Could you explain what that was about?
Yeah, there was like a giant van that said GeneX on it, and it was I can't remember exactly what it said, but it was about like for rich people to wipe their tears away with over the mansion tax, and it was designed like a tissue box, like tissues coming out of the top, and that was like the backdrop to her speech, that and a bunch of people holding signs, and it was kind of like a really beautiful tableau at times.
Beautiful tableau. All right, you heard it here, folks. Politics can be funny. Fun fact. I do think that this Gene Swanson's kind of separate campaign launch on the Saturday was definitely a strategic choice, because a lot of these more sort of class warfare sounding statements and acts wouldn't have fit in so well at the official Cope nomination meeting on Sunday. So on that meeting, yeah, as was mentioned in the report, all of Cope's candidates for school board, parks board, and for city council were finalised. Cope members also heard from all of the candidates who are sort of vying for the left or centre-left position for mayor as well. So Shauna Sylvester, Kennedy Stewart, and Patrick Condon all went and spoke at that event on Sunday and were sort of trying to curry the favour of the Cope membership. The Cope will actually not finalise whether they're going to endorse a candidate for mayor, run their own candidate for mayor, or simply sort of back out and have no say in it until August 19th, which is when they have their final nomination meeting. But in general, people are expecting that they will endorse one of these three candidates because you tend to get a lot more coverage in the election race if you do have a candidate for mayor. At the meeting on Sunday, the people who are currently in the running were asked if they weren't selected by Cope, if they would happily drop out to avoid splitting the centre-left vote further. And Condon said that he would abide by whatever was advised by the parties. Shauna Sylvester said that there is no way she is going to drop out at all. She does not want to leave this race up to the men, as she put it. So you can expect to hear from her at least all the way up until the vote in October. But for now, enough local politics. We're going to take a short break, and after the ads, we'll be joined live in studio by a very special guest to hear about defending yourself against Kinder Morgan.
National Indigenous Peoples Day is June 21st, and CITR 101.9 FM is here to provide you a day of special programming and celebration, with programs on language revitalization, Inuit composers, and much, much more. All day, CITR will be broadcasting content by, with, and for Canada's Indigenous people, from Indigenous-focused music playlists and audio documentaries to in-studio interviews. Tune in Thursday, June 21st from 11 a.m. onwards to hear all of CITR's programming on Indigenous culture, identity, and heritage.
Support
Support the women of the Downtown East Side and spring into the Scotiabank Charity Challenge on June 24th. Join the Downtown East Side Women's Center in crowdsourcing funds and spreading awareness of their organization, which provides safe space, emergency shelter, basic essentials, and a continuum of support to marginalized women. Go to www.dewc.ca/run-4-DEWC for more information.
All right, we are back. Thank you for joining us on Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Our News Collective comrade Aidan Tong is going to be taking over from here to introduce to you Nate, our special guest for the last segment of today's show.
Yeah, so we're lucky enough to be joined by Nate Lewis. He's a fourth-year student at UBC. So in late March, he participated in a protest against the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion at the Kinder Morgan tank farm in Burnaby. As a result, Nate has been one of several hundred protesters arrested for their civil disobedience against the construction of this controversial pipeline. So yeah, do you want to just say hi, Nate?
Yeah, hi. Hi, Aidan.
Okay.
So yeah, as you said, I was arrested in late March, and we were there because, or for me, myself at least, I feel there's a vested interest in protecting BC coastline, and the environment generally, and that's why I was there.
Okay, and I mean, when we had a little discussion before, but you mentioned that there was a little bit of training before you guys went to the protest. I'm just wondering, like, what the training entailed.
Yeah, that's right. For each action that was being run, there was a little bit of a legal briefing, as well as a nonviolent communication seminar in terms of dealing with police in a respectful, nonviolent, but firm, obviously, way.
Okay. And I mean, like, so you're going down there and obviously you were expecting some sort of resistance from your protest, but were you expecting to get arrested that day?
Yeah, I honestly wasn't. I wasn't sure quite what to expect. I did know that participating in the action of blocking the actual gates of the tank farm, I would be subject to arrest because of the injunction that Kinder Morgan had filed with the provincial government a couple weeks before. Before this, in early March, I believe. So I was aware that arrest was on the table, but going into it, I didn't quite know what to expect in terms of resistance or police presence. And it was actually there were no police on the scene when we began our protest at around, I think it was 11 a.m. that day, and the police didn't arrive until a few hours later.
Okay, I mean, like, you're a decently big dude. So, like, how was your treatment from the police? Like, were you handled fairly? Were you handled maybe a little unfairly? Like, how was the treatment in overall?
Well, I don't know if maybe my being male would have affected my treatment or at large. I'm not sure about that. But no, my treatment was fine physically from the police, and in terms of what I saw on that day. No one seemed to be being mistreated, and there certainly was a lot of different groups and in terms of watchdog groups, and the police had their own person recording all the events. So there was a lot of oversight, certainly. Not that it would have gotten out of hand otherwise, but it was a fairly a peaceful process. Okay. I do know that for some people, they were choosing to go limp when police were trying to remove them from the scene in an attempt to slow down the process, and that incurred maybe a little bit either harsher treatment or potentially harsher treatment for people that remained after that, because maybe police were frustrated or fed up with that sort of behavior. But I didn't see any of that on the day that I was arrested.
Okay. Well, you know, what I find interesting is the fact that, I mean, you're a UBC student, you're a local Vancouver boy.
That's right.
And I find, like, a lot of students, a lot of Canadian students, they particularly say they're against the pipeline, but they don't necessarily follow through with their actions. And obviously, what you did is you followed through with your actions and you stood up against this pipeline. So I'm wondering, what type of support were you seeing at the protest?
Sorry, can you clarify your question?
What type of support were you seeing at the protest? Were there a lot of students there? Were there a lot of indigenous
people? In terms of the demographics
of it?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely a lot of support and from indigenous communities, and the movement has actually been spearheaded by the Tsleil-Waututh community specifically, but other communities as well. And that was really inspiring. They had people coming around just talking to us, and they had a lot of emotional support in terms of really helping all of the people that were there standing up to the Kinder Morgan pipeline. I remember it was snowing, and everyone was freezing. We'd been there for hours. I think part of the tactic for the police to not show up on time was to kind of make us sit and wait. So they were handing out soup, and I remember when a woman and her child who lived just down the hill came with like banana bread, and it's definitely a real community coming together, and really you could feel that this was something people really genuinely cared about, people in the community. There's a school right down the hill. We were walking and by a playground, like on our way there, and a kid points at us and says, "Oh, what are they doing?" And the mom just says, "They're protecting your home, your community, your school." And I don't know if that sunk in for the 6-year-old, but it certainly sunk in for me.
No, that's beautiful. I mean, me and Zoe, when we went to the provincial courts to kind of report on some of the people that had been arrested at some more of these protests, there was a clear camaraderie between them because of the similar consequences that they faced. And I find, when you're always kind of in that similar situation as someone, that always kind of binds you together. And especially something like this, I mean, you're fighting for the planet. I find that it's obviously very noble. It's noble what you did. Some would say it's foolish because now you're kind of going to be on trial against a pretty big corporation. But if you had the chance to kind of redo it, would you do it again or would you not?
I would be arrested again, I think. I'm lucky enough to be in a position of privilege where I can afford a lawyer, and there are all sorts of I don't necessarily have to worry about government incursion into, say, stipends or something that if I was being paid in that sort of situation, or I'm not working for the government. So I do have a lot of privilege and a lot of aspects that I understand other people don't. So I wouldn't say it's ignoble for someone to not stand up in that way and take that action. But in terms of myself, I would do it again. I would just note, though, that the courts and the police at the scene were making a very a strong statement that violating the injunction a second time, if you were found on the site again and arrested twice, that would incur a much steeper penalty. And that's what we're seeing with sentencing in the courts right now. So I would say that the people who are really being heroic and actually risking real jail time rather than fines or community service are people that are there every day and are being arrested multiple times.
Wow. Yeah, it's those.
Well, Sayona, just on the front of that injunction, recently Kinder Morgan has been applying for a change to the terms of the injunction, which would mean, so at the moment, once you're issued a warning to leave, you have a reasonable period of time, which they've been interpreting as 5 minutes. Is that right?
I'm not sure how it was interpreted on scene. We were basically, because they were arresting one person at a time, and there were some 50-odd people or 60 the day I was there, it was actually quite a long time where they were really encouraging you to walk away.
Yeah.
They were encouraging you to walk away from this line, this border, that they had established with police presence. But in terms of changing the injunction, as you were saying, my understanding of it is that they want to have it not just be a place where some superficial line is posted, as it has been now. I believe it's 5 meters. But what they actually want to do is put up signs all around the facility saying that being within this being within sight distance of these signs would actually incur arrest potentially, which carries with it obviously all sorts of problems of people being unintentionally or unknowingly arrested.
Yeah. We've just got, a couple more minutes with you in studio, but could you just briefly comment on how those changes, so the change in where the sight line is, as well as having less time to respond to information of an injunction, how that would affect protest tactics out on the mountain?
Well, I'm not totally sure in terms of sight lines and stuff or in terms of what's actually happened. I don't actually know how that would really change it. What I'm interested to see is how protest tactics are going to change, given that it's now not Kinder Morgan that we're protesting. Our Canadian government under good old Mr. Trudeau is now the brand new owner of an old leaky pipeline that they are going to either move off to another bidder or complete themselves in some facet. So we're now actually in a very different situation, it seems, where the people of Canada are actually protesting against their government rather than an American third-party corporation.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting summer for sure, I would say.
Thank
you so much, Nate, for joining us to chat, and to Aidan for all of your brilliant questions. We're going to be wrapping up Democracy Watch for this week. I'd just like to briefly give a shout out to our very excellent, reliable audience. We call her Vera for short. Thank you for listening, Vera. You're our favorite audience member. And remember to tune in next week at 5 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM for more Democracy Watch from the News Collective.